Premium Hoops presents Sense and Scalability.
Sense and Scalability. Welcome to NBA Draft Season. Because it is NBA Draft Season, we thought it would be a no better time than to bring on Henry Ward for the second time. Only two-time guest of the show. How you doing, Henry?
I'm good, Scott. Thanks for having me. It's a big honor to be the first two-time guest. It's TBD if it's a bigger honor than being the first guest in show history, but it's an honor nonetheless.
We really appreciate you coming on again. And of course, I got the other guys with me as well. How you doing, Evan?
Doing fantastic, Scott. Despite the pre-draft crunch, which happens every year, I'm feeling nice and relaxed. I did a little meditation before this, so I'm in my zone and I'm ready to talk draft, baby.
See, what I did was I just dropped that mock draft podcast and just cooked up a bunch of half-baked prospect takes with Giles, and then decided to just sit back and relax and, you know, follow the people who do the draft more than I do, which is you guys. I'm sure you feel similarly, Cody, as a part-time draft analyst. Speaking of Cody, how you doing?
Part-time is very generous to me. I was going to say to all of you listening, this might be the first time you've listened to a draft podcast when one of the hosts knows actually nothing about the upcoming draft. But for today's episode, I would like to think I'm going to take like a Mikal Bridges type of role. I'll stand in the corner. I'll hit a couple corner threes if I need to. If need be, maybe I'll drive in and hit a pull-up mid-range. Who knows? Or maybe I'll just be PJ Tucker and brick my only corner three. We'll see what happens. Stick around and let's find out about my performance today.
Cody was brought into Premium Hoops because he's a dog, but he told us that we are all dogs, and he helped us believe in ourselves. I was trying to extend the PJ Tucker reference. Still get chills from watching that speech, or that interview, I guess, on the championship parade. Anyway, guys.
It's not too late to pivot and make this a Championship Bucks 2.0 podcast.
No, we've gotten that out of our system, or at least as much as we need to. I know you'd love to do that, Cody, but we're going to just let you listen to us talk NBA draft for the next hour, because it kind of evens it out. You know, we indulged you with the Bucks episode, and now we're going to do something you don't really have much interest or knowledge about.
Yeah, Cody, you got to enjoy your championship as a little treat, and now it's draft time.
Yeah,
I got my water. I'm going to the corner. Hit me if you need a spot up at some point.
Yes, exactly. And you know, just like PJ Tucker or Pat Connaughton, it might be your only spot up of the game, but you're going to nail it. Or in PJ Tucker's case, not. And doesn't matter because it will win the championship. So segueing to the draft, last time we had you on, Henry, we kind of talked about, you know, your core philosophies on what you look for in players, teams, etc. You know, you can read about it on Henry Ward's personal blog, The Kick Ahead, called Exposing the Blueprint. Kind of talks about a modest proposal for more motion heavy five out offense in the NBA. Henry, if you want to just do a little recap of that article and kind of your philosophies at large before we get into how they pertain to this draft and certain prospects, I'll just give you the floor for that.
Sure. So I'll start out by saying that there's obvious caveats in all of this. Every prospect is pretty unique. So it would be doing a disservice to like take this overwhelming or overarching view of how I like basketball to be played and then, you know, rule out certain 19, 20 year old prospects from being able to adapt to that style of play. I mean, this might sound hypocritical after the last podcast we all did together.
and what you're also, talking about. Well, yeah, we did that. We punished Henry by making him talk about two guys who are first rounders and everyone else is bored, but he kind of has to play the spoiler for them. That's Alperen Şengün and Cam Thomas. That was over on the Premium Hoops feed. So we'll get to the guys we're going to talk about, but they're going to be much more in line with Henry's philosophy that he'll continue to explain now that I'm done interrupting him.
No, it was a good interruption. And I do, it's, you know, it's hard to apply a ton of nuance to an article or even an hour long podcast. So I just want to put out that there are what I'm about to describe and the things I look for in prospects are things that I value more than maybe the average scout. Doesn't mean that guys that don't fit that bill necessarily are like, you know, gone for me, that I don't care about them. Like I said, each prospect is pretty unique and there's skills that can be gleaned. Some that I, you know, care about more than others, but nonetheless, there are, you know, for example, in the Cam Thomas example, there are, we kind of discussed in the last podcast that there's ways that Cam Thomas is maybe useful in kind of this utopian basketball reality that I'm about to paint. But, you know, in a lot of ways, he's likely not very useful at all. So with that out of the way, I would basically just describe it as kind of moving from the offensive side of the ball forward, heavy emphasis on spacing, not only from the general understanding of it in terms of having guys that can shoot and have gravity and therefore create space, but having guys who can sort of dynamically create that space with cutting and smart relocations and proactive thinking and mapping of the floor. Shooting is obviously a plus, but I also do believe that shooting is relatively developable. So there are guys who can't shoot that I do like quite a bit because of other traits they have. I love guys that are able to show some sort of, you know, multi-positionality offensively. What I mean by that is guys who maybe have plus positional size, but can still handle the ball in spurts, make quick, you know, most importantly, quick, smart decisions with the ball, creatively solve problems. I think there's a lot of value in having players. I mean, this is also partially due to what they bring defensively, but I think there is a lot of value of having guys on offense who do have good positional size and can sort of play, you know, quote unquote, like guards and make things happen with the ball. Kind of having five decision makers on the court at one time is, as we've kind of seen throughout these playoffs and kind of how valuable DeAndre Ayton has been as a growing decision maker and what having five decision makers on the court does for offenses and how hard it is to contain ultimately with NBA spacing. I do think that that is something definitely to prioritize, and guys who, you know, filter through those decisions more creatively and quicker than others are more desirable to me. And then defensively, I think basically the way with kind of how spacing is so important now for many offenses, not even ones that really subscribe to my philosophy, but just like the general NBA offense is much more spaced than it was 3 years ago. So to combat that, I think we should see, and I would personally advocate for some more kind of uphill pressurized defensive schemes, pressuring the ball more, playing above the screens in ball screen coverages from both the primarily the big, you know, quote unquote, the big, the screener defender, I guess I should call him. And basically operating from that premise because it is harder when you are swarmed at the point of attack to break down defenses and make decisions. And when it's harder to do that, then off-ball defenders are kind of given more leeway. And speaking of off-ball defenders, I think it's important that guys have a good feel on that end, know where the responsibilities are. Again, similar to offense, have the ability to sort of creatively solve complex problems. I value a lot sort of, I guess, plus positional rim protection because so much of my philosophy requires, or I guess at this point in like what the player pool looks like in the NBA, it's unlikely that you have a real traditional five that is able to really fulfill kind of my criteria. I think it's important that rim protection is then bolstered from positions like the three and the four to sort of supplant that. And I think I'm kind of covering all of it. I think it's important that guys can cover ground because, like I said, there's just so much talent with the ball in the NBA these days, and you're going to have plenty of guys that need to play help defense, and the less space you give those players by covering ground, using length functionally to close spaces tightly and create closeouts and contain closeouts, I should say, the better off you're going to be in sort of deterring rim protects or rim attempts. So I think that's kind of it generally. Feel free to chime in, guys. I feel like we've talked about this a ton. So if you think I'm missing something that I usually talk about, feel free to add, but I think that covers it.
Just the, I think what I've learned from you is just to value all of this stuff. And maybe this kind of plays into like the rim protection thing, but like there's a lot of guys in like that 6 feet to like 6'6" range who can do the things you're talking about. And there's very few who can do it who are above like 6'8". So I mean, we'll get into it, but like those kind of six to six, eight guys who possess these traits are going to be a little bit higher on your board than others, just because you need to, I mean, obviously, you know, you could be like Air Force and play like all 6'3" guys who can shoot, dribble and pass, but you're not going to be able to stop anyone. So eventually you do have to get some like bigger players out there to play defense.
Right. I think the positional size bit is pretty important. And I think it's often sort of like, depends on different philosophies, obviously, but sometimes I think the general word that people would use is like versatility. But I think that's kind of in itself just a, not lazy, but just like has a lot of shortcomings as a definition of what I'm trying to describe. But an example of like one player that I guess I could use is Scotty Barnes is often viewed as like this sort of amorphous blob, can't really play the five. He's mostly just a four. He's not a handler to play the three. Like, a lot of critics would sort of point out all the oddities that he has, you know, kind of where he fits positionally. But all those oddities initially stem from his, I guess, pluses being in areas in which these players I'm describing, right? Like where he's too big and kind of clunky to play the three, but he can obviously handle, he can obviously pass. Long enough to cover to multiple positions, not quite big enough to, you know, I guess be your sort of like funnel rim attempts to me and I'll handle it rim protector, but I think good enough to play the five and protect the rim if he has kind of more democratic rim protection around him. So for a lot of guys, it's like, you know, he can't play the five because he can't protect the rim. He's not a three because he can't handle. There's not a lot of fours that really do much in the NBA these days. Well, to me, if you just look at all of his skills, it's easy to like creatively find ways to make him a very, very, very positive player with how good he is at certain things and how important those skills are. But for others who I think are lower on him, the issue is more like that versatility doesn't really amount to much in the traditional sense.
And Scotty is somebody who I know you and I are both kind of higher on, I think, than a lot of people we talk to regularly and probably are almost definitely a lot of the mainstream as well. And I agree. Like if you look at him as kind of the sum of what he is now, so the sum of the parts he is now, I can see why, you know, you might have doubts in traditional pathways to success. But for me, Scotty's value comes from a number of, well, I think he has like a number of different avenues in which he can hit a pretty high level outcome for him specifically. And like, I think even the lower end outcomes for him are valuable in a way that not that many players present value similar to nowadays in the NBA. So I do think he has like some of that switchability. And I've said before, especially on, I think it was Upside Swings, I was talking about like the rarest couple archetypes or whatever. And I don't like to necessarily break the draft down into just archetypes, but when you are looking at fulfilling a certain role that requires a certain skill set, basically I think the two rarest are wing size creators and secondary rim protectors who can play the four. And I think Scotty has pathways to either one. I don't think with the handle and the shape it is and the jumper and the shape it is that he's probably going to you know, hit an outcome as a primary, like a wing size primary. But he does have plus playmaking for his position, and he can, I think, do a lot on defense. So just the versatility of outcomes for me is super big plus for him. And I'm looking for, you know, a versatility or a variety of different ways to success in the NBA as a huge positive, I think, in most prospects that I scout.
It reminds me a lot of a conversation I had with my friend who I just did the mock draft with, Giles, today. So kind of a different opinion on a different prospect. I know you have James Bouknight in the 20s. Henry, for Giles, he's five. Big James Bouknight fan. And I was kind of like, just kind of, you know, doing what I do where I was like kind of needling him a little bit, figuring out why he's so high on this. So I said, how much will the pull-up shooting be used? Because I guess that's one thing he has over someone like, you know, Josh Giddey, who might be in that range for some at the moment. And so I said, and therefore, if it's going to be off ball, how much should I value it? And conversely fade like a giddy type who can't do it yet. And then I kind of said, well, I guess the ideal book environment is one that relies on like second side creation. So using the off versus on ball binary kind of misses the point. And then Giles hit the moneymaker quote where he said, yeah. And like in general, I try not to figure out exactly how someone's skills work in the pros and just think about if their overall game can work in a variety of roles. And so these players I like to call roles players as opposed to role players. So that, I guess you could say that while it's a different prospect and it's a different opinion, you can apply a lot of what we were talking about to Scotty Barnes, where it's like, unless you're like, you know, the star player, everything's not going to be geared towards your specific, like optimizing what you do and just being able to play a bunch of different, do a bunch of different things in the muddy game that is often basketball is really helpful if you're not like the main guy or two.
Yeah, I do think, I mean, I know we were just kind of talking about this before we got on, but like the post NCAA tournament draft kind of gap in like time, there's no new tape. It's just a bunch of kind of discussions you've had a million times and people get bored. I try to sort of prevent myself from going into overthink mode and try and create all these weird scenarios and talk myself into certain guys in certain spots. And, you know, I try to avoid flipping guys back and forth spots. If I'm, you know, oh, this guy is this, this, and this. Well, this guy is this. Well, this matters more. And then flip them. Like, that's a dumb thing to do. I think it's productive to a certain extent, but there's just too much time between college basketball ending and the draft, which I think we all fall victim to. And the reason I bring that up is because one of the things I have honestly been thinking about in this period a lot, and I've struggled to sort of parse out and kind of, you know, see what's worthwhile in this train of thought and if what needs to just be tossed aside as like overthinking, is at a certain point, philosophy aside, like some guys are just really good at basketball and they'll figure it out. And like, that's my kind of fear. I've got this fear with a couple guys, but with Book Knight, I don't have it as much because I do generally have like doubts about Book Knight's just like, I mean, immediate translation skill wise in terms of, I think the handle's kind of loose. I think he requires a ton of dribbles to get places, which isn't very efficient. I don't know. I think he's going to be a good shooter, but not like the sort of like nuclear shooter that I think would require if he can't generate the sort of downhill attempts that he got with UConn. I mean, as much as you want to talk about UConn spacing, they did a really good job getting the ball when he was just sprinting off screens and already turning corners. He didn't have to create a ton of angles himself. So yeah, there's that side of me, which is like, here's my evaluation of James Book Knight. This is why I have him at this spot. And that makes sense. And there's part of me where it's like, guy did shoot like 60%+ at the rim with no spacing, like clearly had a bad shooting year, but clearly can shoot. You know, maybe I'm overthinking it, but point being, I think it applies more for me to other players. Like a guy that I've thought about that a lot with is Jared Butler. And I've honestly with him is my result with him is I've sort of risen him a little bit. Treif Cooper, same thing. And yeah, I think it's a worthwhile point. Like some guys are just really good basketball players. And we really think about like, well, this skill, he'll need this skill to perform in this role really well. And he doesn't have this, so he won't be able to do that. Like, no, he probably will be able to do that because, like, he'll find a way like he did in college. And that's just that sometimes. So I think it is – I do like that point by Giles is he can just play roles.
Roles player. Yeah, and that's the hard part for me is, like, who is playing the way they are, like, Book Knight because that's how they're just – that's the only way they can play. And who is doing that because they know that's what's best for their team at that given moment. And, you know, that adaptability will translate over to a scaled down role in the NBA. That's always like the hardest question for me every draft.
Yeah, I think the yes, I agree with that point. And for me, a lot of the struggle is certain players are really good and still don't work that well in the positive. It might, you know, we've talked about this a ton whenever I come on a podcast with you guys, but positive context and like what a positive player is. Like I still fully, honestly, don't really feel all that confident in my Shreve evaluation. Like I feel like I've watched a bunch of Shreve Cooper games twice at this point. Like there's nothing that I'm learning at this point about his game, But my biggest hanging up point with him is he's an unbelievable passer. Like, obviously, in my opinion, I would take Cade and maybe Giddey, but those guys are also generational. Like, he is really that good of a passer. And it's very valuable to have a guy that can just generate an advantage from any scenario at any time. Like, that's a very valuable thing to have. But I do worry about the shooting, because I don't care that much about like the pull-up equity and pick and rolls and what about teams going under. Like, teams went under all year and he didn't give a shit. He blew by everybody that ever tried to guard him. At any level, if they picked him up low, picked him up high, he figured it out. My worry is, like, could Treif Cooper operate on a team with an elite player? Because he has to kind of be that elite player in a lot of settings, because he's not going to play off the ball at all if he can't shoot. And that is, like, a concern I have with, you know, I guess FOMO per se. Like, I have him 13 right now. If I really believed he could shoot and, like, scale off the ball in that way, I'd probably have him like 7 or 8. Cause he's that smart of a player. I don't really care about the defense that much from someone that's offensively talented. Like, I'm not going to fall into the Trey trap again. But it is a concern with him. Like, if he is as good as he is, but he can't shoot, what does he look like on the Clippers? What does he look like on the Celtics? What does he look like on teams where the majority of decisions is being funneled through a wing or two wings, or like a wing and a big in the Lakers case? Like, on a really good team with the best players, he's not going to be the best player. So he has to figure out a way to coexist off the ball. And if he, you know, is on a really good team as like the second or third best player, there's a very small sort of combination of guys that he could play with well. Like, you kind of have to be with like Giannis, Embiid, Anthony Davis, you know, some combination of those type of guys. So it's a worthwhile question. Like, that is where I do have those questions of, this skill does really matter in this role, even though he is undeniably very, very good, and a very good prospect, and one that excels in traits I value. That's like a big hanging up point for me.
I guess in Sharif's case, it's not only the shot, but like, can he dissect the advantages created by other players, I think, is the question behind your question. And we see that with some guys where they're much more comfortable dissecting the advantages that they create. I think the example that comes to mind for me is Tobias Harris on the Clippers. You know, he could run a pick and roll where he got the screen, had a few dribbles, got to, you know, look at the weak side tag, et cetera. Traded to the Sixers, basically the fourth option at best in a lot of those lineups. And all of a sudden he is warping the defense based on, I guess, what his teammates do. He has to interpret where, you know, the pressure points are, even though they have been stimulated before he got the ball. So with someone like Sharif, and I guess in general, like, do you have any things you look for in trying to determine if a guy can, you know, scale down to a decision-making role where he's not the one making the dent?
Yes, this is, I'm really glad you asked this, because this is, I think, one of my biggest sort of philosophy points that gets me yelled at a lot by basically everybody I know at this point, which is, I really dislike when small guards are tasked with funneling every play finishing decision, which is what Sharif is at this point. It's what, you know, I got burned a little bit this playoffs because I made this take well known before the playoffs started, and then Chris Paul and Trae Young were in conference finals. You know, Chris Paul's in the finals. Thankfully for Cody's Bucks, I don't have to answer for them actually winning titles. But it is a it's kind of a thesis that I have stuck to, and I think I still maintain it. You know, the playoffs did challenge it a little bit, but I do really worry about what offenses look like and where their ceilings are when you do have these somewhat limited small guards who rely on like this very unique, like, not advantage creation style, but for Chris Paul, it's like the mid-range game. For Trey, it's the nuclear shooting. And, you know, I think it differs from a player like Steph, because Steph is very comfortable letting other players make the play finishing decisions. He's so active off the ball. He knows what gravity generates. I mean, he played for Draymond in all these years. He, you know, goddamn brought on Kevin Durant and they made it work. Like, I think he's very comfortable not making those play finishing decisions, but small guards who really just command the ball all the time, and Sharif fits this bill, make you really nervous because we've never really seen an offense that's really hit like the peak in a single season throughout the playoffs. When things slow down, they've maintained that peak when that's the case, like when their offense hinges on that sort of player. So that's a concern I have. But I think you also eloquently bring up a side point there, which is the value of guys who are used to not making those play finishing decisions, but still have that sort of, not gravity, and it's not really advantage creation either. It's like that, it's like ability to play off the bend, which is why I've gotten really hot on Jared Butler, honestly, is because my whole thing, our pal Jake Rosen is a huge Jared Butler guy, and I like to always push back when we would have like our locker room shows or just be texting individually. When I watched Butler, I always got caught up on the fact that he always needs a screen. Like, he has a great handle. He's really good at punishing advantages when guys are backing up, but he can never break that first line. It's always got to be with the screen, which at first was like a huge negative for me because obviously as I've made well known, I'm not a huge fan of running a ton of pick and rolls. I like to sort of have a more creative, kind of egalitarian way of creating advantages. And Butler couldn't really seem to do that. But then as I kind of have come along, I realized like, well, it's actually a good thing because he's just really good at attacking tilts when they're there, like extremely good. That's all he does. So in some ways that player may be more valuable. And I do think that that is sort of an interesting thing to parse out, because a lot of it kind of has to do with like mentality, even in ways that like intel interviews can't really answer for. Because for a guy like Sharif, you know, if he committed to kind of becoming that Butler type player, certainly has the handle, the proactive kind of floor mapping and the passing to do so. Doesn't have the shooting, obviously, but if you're really banking on Sharif's high end outcomes, you're assuming that comes around anyway. But Butler already has it. So while, you know, Sharif might be better, Butler still might fit that sort of idea better anyway. And it's a very odd sort of micro skill that I think just is only able to be parsed out when you see it. I'm not sure. I mean, I'd love to hear if anyone's got suggestions of how to figure it out beforehand, but I certainly don't know how yet.
Well, I don't know how to figure out either, but my entire brand is not taking play connectors, those people who can continue advantages created by others. My whole brand is not taking those types of players for granted. My favorite players in the league are like Joe Ingles, like Nick Batum. I
thought you were going to say not taking those players in the draft, and I was going to get.
Oh no, I love taking those players. I just don't like taking them for granted. You know, I just think that it's a pretty difficult skill, and there's so many guys who are not that good at it who are in the NBA. And are like these 6'8 guys. So the ones who can play on the wing and also continue plays, like, for example, I was somebody in like the bubble run who was a little bit higher on like Gordon Hayward and Marcus Smart's role on the Celtics, and a little bit lower on someone like Jaylen Brown, who was ultimately the points depository for a lot of those actions, but he himself wasn't necessarily continuing the dents created by others to the same degree that someone like Hayward was.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can open this up to a larger discussion. I do think that is like that idea is sort of a thing I value a lot just in my general philosophy. It's guys who have those skills that you're describing. A lot of that is like feel and you know, plus handling for your position, decision making. So I do think that we see eye to eye on that and have the value of those players. And I'm going to avoid this rant. I'll save it for another time down the road, but I'm loving watching international basketball because we've seen it makes me sad to watch USA lose these games. But like this whole year, I've been banging the drum on like the value of connectors and how sort of general consensus seems to view connectors as like a very limited archetype that you need a ton of creation around to really like get the most out of them. And then we see these like international teams whose best players are quote unquote connectors beating the US, whose entire team is creation. And I think it just proves, you know, I don't think it's like a big enough sample to really make a solid opinion out of thin air with, but like, I do think that it's an interesting case point in the sort of idea that the value of the connector and the value of the advantage creator have been for a while viewed so disproportionately. There's been a huge gap there. Like the advantage creators are the absolute pinnacle of team building. You need one, you need as many as you can get, et cetera. Connectors can come later. You'll figure those out. Those guys are everywhere. And now we're seeing that like, no, really good connectors are a great way to win. Like you can creatively find ways to win with really good connectors. And of course you need creation. You're not just going to swing the ball around for 24 seconds, but usually those connectors have skills that make them like viable off-ball, quote unquote, off-ball creators that when put in the right situations can become, you know, more, I guess, on-ball creators if you, like I said, creatively put them in situations where, you know, they're not tasked with breaking guys down off the dribble, but where there is, you know, some sort of, within the scheme, some mechanism built in to get them some sort of advantage to play out of, they'll do pretty well with that.
Yeah, and we've seen time and time again how like the presence of those connectors, those like high feel connectors who can kind of interrogate space and make the right decision, keep the ball swinging and get other guys open if the advantage has already been created. Those guys are actually really helpful for building a developmental ecosystem that actually like makes sense. You're training your players to play in an environment where if they give up the ball and they get themselves into an advantageous position, you know, moving after they've given it up, they're going to be found and rewarded for that advantageous position. And so you can kind of continue to iterate on these good decisions by offering an instantaneous reward. Whereas like in a developmental ecosystem where, you know, you don't have that kind of infrastructure in place of all these guys who are going to make the right decision, who want to play team basketball and really keep it moving, you kind of don't incentivize good decision making as strongly as you probably would want to, for that to be something that's ingrained in the developmental kind of philosophy of your organization and the core that you end up building around it. So those glue guys, I mean, like that, there gets to a point in the draft where like I think all the real primary bets are gone, and we're essentially looking at like I start to look at wing size guys who can be connectors. And who can hold their own at either one or two positions, whether it's like a wing defender 2-3 or a combo forward 3-4 type defender. If you can defend two positions and you're going to make the right decision more often than not, you have at least one offensive skill that's going to keep you on the floor, like even if it's just like converting easy buckets down low or attacking downhill after an advantage has been created for you, attacking closeout, something like that. That's valuable to me. And I think it gets into an overall discussion about the economy of the draft and like what archetypes are available and when you start to just when you want to take swings versus when you just want to like lock in and get a guy who you feel reasonably confident will produce. But yeah, the glue guys are really important. And I think like Memphis is a good example of hitting on bets for those kinds of guys later in the draft and being able to build a developmental environment that I guess gets you competing a little bit earlier than you might expect just because you've trained in this environment where good decision making is rewarded.
Yeah, I really want to kind of expand upon that because, two things really. Just what we're talking about, the availability of like, you know, top tier primary creators is so scarce. So more often than not, you're going to have, you know, a like what the Grizzlies are doing, where I say Ja is very close. He could, you know, reach that echelon, but right now he's kind of comfortably below those top primary creators like Luka and perhaps Trey now. So all of a sudden you basically, the better your play connectors are, the worse your primary creation can be, and still be viable. You know, you might look at some like the Magic with like Cole Anthony or like the Cavs with Darius Garland, kind of like burgeoning guys who maybe need a little bit of that assistance because, and I think we've talked about this graph before, but it's a very popular one in developmental psychology, where there's like a linear line and below it is boredom and above it is like anxiety. And we'll call that for this case friction. What Evan's describing is, you know, if there aren't those play connector types, sometimes if there aren't those play finishers for your developing primary, there can be more friction than is helpful for them to actually learn how to do the job. Because it's not clear what does and doesn't work when you don't have the proper tools to extract what the primary creator can do. And so, yeah, obviously you want to give them enough opportunities. You don't want them to reduce to boredom, but when you do kind of challenge them, you want to have be able to grease the wheels a little bit with those play connectors, with, you know, a high percentage finishing big, with some, you know, otherworldly lob threat. There's all these like little ways, and that's why all these like positive players, even if you can question the archetype of someone like, you know, Shangoon, to bring it back to last podcast, there are a bunch of little ways to reduce friction of your primary creator. So even outside of, you know, the winning potential, like Evan and other people were saying of the play connectors, they're just really great from a developmental perspective. And I'm glad you mentioned that.
For sure. And I think that the, you know, I think that there is maybe a little bit over-indexing that happens on like searching for kind of like one to two skills that make someone a connector. And ultimately, I think we've seen with guys like Mikhail, guys like Kevin Herter, some of the best connectors are just the guys that are really good and okay not having the ball, which is why I'm super in on Franz Wagner, is because like, even if you don't, like the whole Franz wiring discussion is so ridiculous to me. It's not ridiculous from the standpoint of like, yeah, it's important discussion to have to like kind of parse out what a ceiling is and his ultimate evaluation. But like if you're bumping him down your board because you're worried he's not going to like want to shoot shots that he doesn't feel comfortable in terms of like, you know, I think that basically for those who haven't heard the argument is that Franz this past year at Michigan passed up a lot of open threes. And people worry that that means that he is, you know, some people worry that means he can't shoot. I don't subscribe to that. And some people worry that it's sort of a problem because there's going to be some sort of like record scratch moments with him. Sort of, if he's not willing to shoot and guys don't close out hard, like what's he doing with the ball? But he's so good at sort of like Michigan ran, they spammed the hell out of these like second side pick and rolls where they'd swing it around. They'd try to dump it into Hunter Dickinson. And eventually they'd swing it to Franz on the weak side and Hunter would step up and they'd run like a little kind of weak side pick and roll. And Franz is really good at making reads out of those. He'd finish a lot. He's giant. You know, he's like 6'9", 6'10" at this point. Can handle the ball. Very smart passer. So guys like that who just like are very good at putting the ball in the deck, making decisions, and creatively getting through those problems, like they're super valuable to have. Because like you said, if Ja, you know, our Grizzlies have now traded up to 10. I think Franz is probably gone before then, but let's say he's not. And next year you have situations where, like, you know, teams are kind of playing under on Ja still. The explosion isn't, you know, flying the same way it has this past year, where it basically just didn't matter how teams covered him. He just found a way to the middle of the paint anyway. Well, a great way to relieve that is because, I mean, the way you're keeping Ja out of the paint is by collapsing towards the paint. So swing it to your buddy Franz, who's going to have a closeout because someone's going to be in that process over helping. That's going to have to close out on Franz. I believe in him as a shooter. So he'll either make open shots or he will attack those closeouts just like he did at Michigan with good ball handling, very smart passing, and decent interior finishing. Like that's a very, like exactly what we've talked about. Like that takes a lot of Ja's burden away because it doesn't have to finish with him. And yeah, I think Herter's been like the premium example of this past year, and what he did for Trae Young in the playoffs and his ability to shoot and obviously score at multiple levels and put the ball on the floor and hit Capella on sort of dump offs and kick out to guys. It's like, it's just the more offensive skill you have on the floor, the better off you are. And when those guys are giant and can guard wings and can cover ground, it's a massive plus defensively too. I think it's a really positive player. I don't think it requires a ton of, you know, overthinking to see the value in that type of player in the draft, even if he doesn't, you know, have the primary equity that you'd want theoretically from the 8th pick slot. Like that's a really good player. And I don't even think you're like really sacrificing that much in terms of value. It's not like you're making like the Cam Johnson pick at 11. Like you're getting a really good player. I think for reasons we've outlined, is also just great for young teams who are usually the ones picking the lottery too.
Yeah. I think, you know, I do get kind of annoyed when guys don't just let it fly. But now that I'm thinking about it, I just said Nick Batum is like one of my favorite players. And that was something I noticed in the Clippers series, was there was some like corner opportunities where I'm just like, just shoot it, Nick. Like, I know you have all these play connection things, but just shoot it. But ultimately, I don't really care, because there's a difference between like a guy like Nick Batum not pulling it and a guy like Marcus Morris, his teammate, not pulling it, where, you know, one is going to, he's probably going to put the ball on the deck and create a look for someone else. Whereas Marcus sometimes just, instead of shooting it, you know, reset the play and isolated, he did do a better job of not doing that in the playoffs. But that was a hang up I had with him in his past stints. So yeah, I guess I think it's just, I think people just like, there's this visceral reaction to a guy just not pulling it, when really maybe that underscores how often them getting the ball ends up in a positive play.
And I think that it depends, you know, when the game is being played too, because I think the Marcus Morris example is a good one, right? Like, Marcus Morris knows that when the games really, really matter, it's important that he kind of pulls that shot, right? But in the regular season where he's kind of innings eating, there are two different Marcus Morrises. Marcus Morris will do ISO creation things in the regular season that you're not going to see him do in the playoffs. And I think the theory of the situation, this is why we look at different contexts, because with Franz Wagner, with the national team, I think he would pull that shot no problem. Now, I don't know what it was about the Michigan context specifically. He did have some other shot makers around him, and maybe he wanted to kind of play a more ancillary role, and he took pride in being, you know, like a glue guy on offense and a prime high-level defender on defense. But I think that the theory of Franz as a player relies on him taking that shot, and he's a smart player who is going to realize that quickly if he doesn't already, which he probably does. The theory of Franz's highest value is with him as a floor spacer who can make good decisions, who can attack closeouts, and who's going to guard, you know, multiple positions and cause events on the defensive end as well. And I think that I believe in the theory of that vision. So the wiring questions are legitimate and something that is worth discussion, but I think we get to the point where we're so close to the draft that people are bored and they're overanalyzing things that are relatively small concerns. It's important to pick the nit, but we don't have to pick it to death. And so I still have Franz at 8 on my board, because that kind of player is extremely attractive. And I like that, Henry, you kind of hit on like the theory of getting that player at 10 and the value that that presents, because I think there are you, yes, want to take as many guys as you can with primary equity if you're still looking for that primary creator. But I think that a lot of people are too gracious in where they draw the line for where guys that are available do have primary equity and guys who are available who kind of really don't. So I'm not going to shake my head at drawing that line near 8 and being willing to take, you know, a high-level glue guy who you really believe in, who can improve the context of your offense.
Yeah, and I think this ties in well, Evan, to the question that you asked that I think we kind of glossed over and we're now able to get back to it, which is like the idea of FOMO in the draft, and specifically like in this draft where that hits for us. And I think that ties in well, because this draft, basically beyond like looking at my board, I haven't really thought about it in this way. I think it just kind of happened organically, but looking at it now, it's basically like first four guys, like, I mean, Cade, obviously, Mobley, special. Suggs and Green, like, might have primary, quote unquote. I mean, I hate saying the whole primary thing, but like, for the sake of kind of our discourse and the colloquialism, you know, we have primary sort of equity down the line.
Yeah, not Scotty, black and white, but you can see them fulfill that responsibility here and there at least.
Right. I think at the heart of what the primary sort of label means is like, you think they're really good and deserve to have the ball a lot. So that's how I feel about them. I don't want to break down my whole board here, but basically then like it then oscillates between, you know, I've got like Scotty 5, Giddy 6, Franz 7, Jaden Springer 8, Moody 9, Zaire 10. And like that basically is an oscillation between like, you know, I think that Giddy at his optimal outcome has that sort of like primary type skill level and impact and skill set that allows for him to have the ball a ton and drive that offense that way. But I'm not totally sold on that definitely happening in the way that I am with like Cade, for example. So I have him below Scotty, who I don't think will ever fulfill that role, but will be so, you know, so excellent and so unique in the value he provides on both ends, and mostly I think a lot of the value comes from how unique he is, that I would probably take the swing on Scotty beforehand, because I think that getting a player that's like Scotty does a ton for you in terms of what you're able to build out beyond that. And then it's sort of like, yeah, the same thing with Franz and Springer. Like, I've got Franz ahead of Springer because I think that Springer might, you know, I think after Springer, they're like quote unquote creation bets. I guess, except for like Sharif, get really, really murky. So like, I'm comfortable maybe taking a swing on him earlier than I would in a vacuum, just because that's a really valuable thing to have as a guy that can sort of like operate offense for you in spurts, pretty single-handedly. I don't really believe in many people behind him being able to do that. So I'm willing to sort of swing on that early, but not earlier than I am with Franz for all the reasons we've talked about. So like, it is an interesting sort of thing of like, you know, creation, sort of that I don't want to call it creation, really, really high offensive skill level, is kind of the king of basketball right now. And you don't want to miss out on it. And therefore it makes sense to sort of take, you know, later beyond the sort of core group, some higher variance bets on guys who may be able to provide something close to that, knowing that it may not totally work out as maybe you hoped with your given sort of pick slot value ascribed to them. And the reason I bring that up now is because like, I've got Zaire at 10, who's a perfect example of that. Like, I think that Zaire, if he completely hits, which I think he can, if a team is really smart about how they bring him along, is one of the most viable players in the draft. Because he's 6'10", he's an amazing shooter. He knows how to get to a shot. He's really smart and he uses all of his size defensively and he's quick. So he can guard multiple positions and cover responsibilities really well. But I don't know, you know, I'd have him a little bit higher if I was more confident in his ability to like gain probably the necessary 25 pounds, as fast as he'll need to. And then kind of the interesting case I have here, which I've gone back and forth on a lot, is having, despite the miserable year, BJ Boston 17, because I do think BJ represents, it's a very interesting case because this banks a lot on what you've seen before this most recent draft year. But BJ, from what we saw in high school, there are certainly things that were, in hindsight, were indicators in high school that he would struggle in college. And they're not, you know, guys like, you know, our pal Max Carlin, who said he was the second best prospect in the class. There are reasons that that didn't happen. But I do think too, on the other end, that we've seen guys, it's a trope at this point, guys go to Kentucky, be put in a shit context. And then they get to the league and all of a sudden it looked like they did in high school again. I don't think that's really going to happen with BJ. Like I said, there are things hindering that from happening in terms of how he plays and how his frame limits him for how he wants to play. But I do think that if you get like 70% of what high school BJ looked like he could be at like the 17th pick slot, that's like going to be an amazing pick for somebody. And I think it's more likely, seeing mock drafts and stuff, that you're going to get that at like the 30th pick, which is crazy to me. But I've thought about like sort of valuing guys like Kessler or Jared Butler or Corey Kispert or Joel Ayayi or whoever, a little bit higher than Boston because of sort of the, you know, general lack of skill, I guess you could say, lack of impact he had this year. But just knowing what we know and knowing what for him, like, you know, it's one thing for like Tyler Hero to not look great at Kentucky and then get drafted like 14th or whatever, and then look really good his rookie year in a very optimized role for him. But like, considering what BJ looked like pre-college, if like there's any bit of that talent there that actually might be NBA level, I really want a piece of it. And for those who haven't seen BJ Boston high school tape, I encourage you to Google it. He's basically a 6'7 with a 7'1, 7 foot wingspan, really creative handler and a really talented off the dribble shooter. And was a good finisher in high school. I'm less confident that translates because a lot of it's very physicality based, but a very good shot creator at 6'7 who can also play defense. That's a player I want to have, especially if I can get him after the lottery. So speaking of FOMO, I kind of have gone back and forth with BJ, but I'm sticking with him, you know, borderline lottery, because I don't want to miss out on that.
Yeah, and BJ is a really interesting one to look at because that's another case where it all depends what tape you watched and how much stock you put into the high school stuff or the AAU stuff for that matter. Because he is a really attractive prospect as a guy who is a wing-sized dribble shoot guy, at least to shoot in some contexts and dribble if the rest is working for him, I think. Now, I think I ended up fading him a little bit more than I expected to, just given the catch and shoot stuff. But one of the things I will generally always bet on is you know, players with physical weaknesses, improving those in the gym at the NBA level with NBA strength and conditioning. Now, if there are frame reasons why I don't think they can kind of add that weight, or if the athletic limitations are more like flexibility based, although I think NBA teams are getting better with that too, I will generally still bet on those athletic improvements. So like Zaire Williams is a guy that I'm willing to bet on once you get to that kind of like 8 through 11, 12 range, I think, no problem. BJ Boston is a guy who I'm probably betting on in the late first if I'm a team who is interested in acquiring kind of a high variance prospect in that range as opposed to someone who's a little bit more complete. But like, you're right, every mock draft I've seen has BJ going in the second round, basically. And like, once you get to the second round, like, there are basically 40 players who matter in every draft, and like, I've seen him go basically as late as 40. I am totally okay taking that bet because I think that while the variance is high, like the high-end outcomes are just so attractive that you have to take the swing, especially if you're looping back around, you know, to the bad teams who draft in the early part of the first and the early part of the second. Like, if you get up to your second pick in the draft in the early second round and BJ's not gone, what are you waiting for? Just take the swing, especially if you took a more complete guy in the early first.
And the last few minutes that we've spent talking about Zaire and BJ Boston are like why I ride for Henry's, you know, kind of ideal philosophies is, as I affectionately call them, Henry Ball. Because we've kind of danced around this, but like inevitably players get siloed into like an on or an off ball player. And I think that's when you start to fade guys like Zaire or Boston, because it's like, yeah, sure, he can like kind of shoot off the dribble, but like, will he get the opportunity to do that in an NBA offense? And what people mean by that is they're, you know, thinking of like a pick and roll heavy offense where it's mostly just one guy making all the high leverage decisions and, you know, doing all the things, shots that aren't like threes or layups. And so it's very hard in that, if you're thinking like that, to contextualize someone like BJ Boston. Like, as good as his high school tape was, like, none of us think he should be, you know, just give the ball to him and let him run 75 pick and rolls a game. So I think someone like, you know, Trey Murphy might get the edge over him because he seems more suited towards that off ball role, which is what you have to do in a pick and roll heavy offense, according to this zeitgeist, if you're not a pick and roll ball handler. So yeah, a lot of these guys do have things they can contribute to NBA offense. Like, Zaire can shoot off the dribble. BJ Boston can shoot off the dribble, can, you know, create driving lanes for himself sometimes. And we've kind of just siloed, like I said, these players in the on and off ball when the reality is a lot muddier, when the reality of most players' games is there are things that they can do with the ball if you let them, if you can incorporate that into your offense. So when you have five guys, you know, who can all shoot, dribble, and pass, and the angles bubble up through just that amount of space you have, I think Clippers are kind of the proof of concept. Like, I mean, Reggie Jackson, not really a primary, but he got plenty of opportunities to shoot off the dribble. Kawhi and Paul George, people ask like, oh, maybe, I don't know if they can run an offense. And like, when Paul George was put in like a spread pick and roll offense, you know, it kind of yielded mixed results. But as soon as you just spread it out and, you know, kind of blur the line between on and off ball player, that's when the reality of these guys' games gets to like be actualized, as opposed to saying either you're going to run a bunch of pick and rolls or you're not.
Yeah, that's why I really don't love the – I feel like we've gotten to the point where basically for all the reasons you just said, Scott, like the – if you're a primary, you got to get picked in the first five picks. And if you're not a primary, then you got to have all these other ancillary skills that primaries don't have to be, you know, a lottery pick. But then we get this like all primary means. And the reason anybody's a primary is because they're really talented offensively, can make different things happen in different situations in ways that other players can't. There's not a certain set of skills that makes you a primary or not a primary. This is kind of not to loop in another sort of like player tangent, but like this is Trey Mann comes to mind here, because I feel like the whole Trey Mann argument for everyone that loves Trey Mann is, well, he could be a primary because he's really good at pull-up shooting out of pick and rolls. And he can get downhill leveraging that shooting. That's great, but don't make the pitch for him. Like, I think that if you think he's really that good at those two skills, then it makes sense to have him ranked super high in the lottery. But I think my gut tells me that there is overcorrection happening in sort of the way his skill set lends to a role that we find attractive, in the sense that like, oh, what we're seeing now is the value of point guards who can shoot really well off the dribble in pick and roll against drop coverage and can attack downhill when teams try to play at the screen. But just because he can do those things well compared to other prospects in the class, it doesn't make him better than other prospects in the class just because the best players in the NBA do those things better than everybody else. Like, I don't know if that made sense, but there's just a very strong commitment made to what a primary looks like. And I think it's just better to acknowledge that this is dumb and in a very unnuanced way of saying things, but you just want basketball players that can do different things really well and better than other basketball players can, which maybe sounds like somewhat hypocritical to those who say that, like, I'm, you know, reach too much for like wings and stuff. But the reason I reach for wings isn't because I need to have like wings for the sake of having wings. I've explained this plenty. I'll say it again. The reason I reach for wings is because wings are often the players that do hold the skill sets I value most, which is offensive versatility and defensive versatility and the ability to make things happen off the ball and with a live dribble or without a live dribble on offense and defensively guard multiple positions and help protect the rim. That's why wings work, not just because they're wings. It's because they're the players most apt in providing value in those skills that I would seek out in the way I would build a team. So yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Scott, because I do think the primary, non-primary, off-ball skill role, 3 and D, et cetera, just loses a ton of, like, you just end up whiffing on guys because you're reaching for archetypes over players.
And I think when you talk about Trey Mann or you talk about even a James Bouknight, and those are two examples of guys that I think at least you and I have a little bit lower than probably consensus. I think so much of that is that the alarm bells ring when you watch them play. You think, okay, that's a primary. And part of that is because they're being employed as a primary by their current team. Now, so much of that is necessity and not necessarily what they're going to be best at the NBA level. And the jump from a college qualified primary to an NBA qualified primary is the biggest jump in professional basketball. So, like, when you look at those guys and you're like, okay, well, that's a primary bet. Is that a primary bet, or is that just somebody who played as a primary creator in college or in high school that it made sense for them to do it at the time, but who perhaps doesn't stand a super high probability, who doesn't put up a super high probability of fulfilling those responsibilities at the NBA level? And if they don't fulfill those responsibilities at the NBA level, what is the probability that they can downshift to an ancillary role that plays off of somebody else who is more equipped or better equipped, rather, to fulfill those responsibilities for their pro team? And how long does it take for them to get there? And so that is a good example, I think, of why even though you could consider them to be primary bets, and they do have legitimate outcomes where they, you know, improve. For Bouknight, it's, I think, his handle and kind of the way he sees the floor. And for Trey Mann, it's definitely the way he sees the floor. I think the handle is more or less pretty good, and the pull-up is actually really nice for a player that age. But if they can improve those weaknesses, there are outcomes where they are valuable as probably, like, underqualified primary, overqualified secondary. I hesitate to say that they would be like the creator of high level offense on championship teams, even at their best. But all this to say, like, yes, those bets are valuable, and at some point, like, they're too valuable for me to pass up on. But Otherwise, I am willing to kind of miss out on the what I consider to be a low probability of those guys hitting those high level outcomes in favor of guys whose lower outcomes are a little bit more useful to me, hopefully.
That's kind of tough because I'm not sure if that contradicts or confirms what I was saying.
How so?
Well, I just feel like I don't want to necessarily fade. Like, it's one thing to overhype Trey Mann because he is a primary bet in your mind. But what Evan was, what you were talking about sounds like just fading him because you're operating under the assumption that he's not a primary and that he doesn't have the ancillary skills that you need to play more of an off-ball role. So I'm almost like kind of dubious of your point.
Sorry, which player are we?
Trey Mann, because we kind of talked about how a lot of players fill that gulf between primary and secondary, and you know, playing motion heavy five out kind of allows them to live in that gray area. Where it sounds like you're saying fade these guys if they can't conform to a primary role because they don't have the ancillary skills that quote unquote off ball players have.
So I would amend that to say, and I'm not necessarily fading these guys because I don't think they have the ancillary skills. Although in Trey Mann's case, I think you have to ask yourself the question, yes, the pull-up is good, but how valuable is the pull-up if he's not the one with ball in hand the majority of the time? And if he isn't the one with ball in hand the majority of the time, how much do you buy the catch and shoot? And if he's not shooting every time, like how much do you buy the ability to keep the ball swinging and maybe hit like more difficult skip passes? Because for me, I think the catch and shoot is something I would buy. And so I'm still in on Trey Mann, you know, I think just outside the lotto to like mid 20s, even in anywhere in the first round. I think he's a first round player. But the vision is where things start to kind of break down for me because he's essentially then going to be, I don't think his like vision of the court is that high level. And I don't know if I would rather bet on that than bet on other players in his range. But if the vision doesn't get there, then he is essentially a play finisher who finishes plays out at the arc. And if you just want a shooter, I think there are other better shooter bets. For Book Knight, you're looking at kind of off ball defense, and the ability to provide like secondary creation either with the dribble or as a catch and shoot guy. And honestly, I think I have it the other way around on my board, but the more I talk to myself about it, I think I may actually flip Book Knight and Trey Mann and slot Book Knight a little higher than I have Trey Mann. Just because I do believe in Book Knight's ability. I think Trey Mann is probably a better primary bet. But if I don't think either one is going to be a primary, I would rather bet on Book Knight's ancillary skills because I think he's better equipped to fill like a secondary or tertiary role. Does that make sense? So I'm not necessarily fading them, but yeah. I start to get a little bit more critical about the rest when you can't bank on the scoring being their most important and most valuable skill.
Basically, I was interpreting you as saying like, oh, I'm going to fade Trey Mann because he doesn't have those off-ball skills that we kind of crusaded against for a little bit. You know, how like players can have on-ball skills even if they're not an on-ball player and you can extract the value. That was what I thought you were saying. But now I realize you're saying I'm fading Trey Mann because I don't think he's a very good prospect.
Yeah, and I wouldn't even say like that exactly because I think he's like a fine prospect and like there's going to be value, I think. Like, I think he's an NBA level player. I think even if like the higher level outcomes don't hit, he's going to be a valuable third guard for somebody who is going to be able to create and make tough shots at a level that I think will provide value. Like, he can stretch the floor, I think, further out than NBA range too, which is a skill that I think will continue to grow in popularity. So I wouldn't say that I think he's a bad prospect, but when I'm looking at kind of those third guard types, there are bets that I like better, if that makes sense, even in this draft in kind of his range.
No, yeah, that does make sense. Like, as much as you can say you want to spread the wealth and like make it so there's no on-ball players and no off-ball players, at the end of the day, the line is somewhere. And at the end of the day, you do have to like, you know, consider what skills scale well to a guy who doesn't have the ball a ton. So I guess this is the part where I basically talked myself into a corner and made watching 19-year-olds play basketball a lot more complicated than it needs to be, which is a favorite pastime of mine in the NBA draft. Henry, you're nodding your head. You think I'm appropriately handling the situation?
Yeah, I think I was literally about to say before you said that, I was about to pop in and say that it's hilarious how complicated scouting is. Like, it just is. It is insanely complicated. Like, the second we just had this long discussion on the philosophy of like primaries and secondaries and where certain skills can be gleaned from and how you evaluate that. And then Ev started talking about how he believes in Trey Mann's catch and shoot ability, which is something I don't believe in. And then for me, he is no longer like, we basically just went in a circle because of reasons unforeseen in the original debate, right? So like, because then we end up with someone like me who's saying, I don't know if I'd take Trey Mann that high, because if he's not good enough to be a primary, then he is probably going to be playing off the ball more, and he won't be that good off the ball because he's not that good off the catch and shoot. And I think it's the reason that is, and the reason I believe that is because it's funny that we use this example, because I did spend like an hour a couple of days ago out of curiosity and like to scratch an itch watching every Trey Mann catch and shoot possession on Synergy. And his footwork is way worse. His gather is messed up. Like he said, there's his feet a lot. He misses left, right a ton. And I don't, you know, wouldn't be able to tell you without like watching him in a workout up close or talking to him. But my gut tells me, just like as someone who played basketball growing up, it is a different process shooting off the dribble and shooting off the catch, just in terms of like your organization and guys like Trey Mann, who have obviously or I shouldn't say obviously, because I think, you know, Trey actually gets, Trey doesn't feel the same ramifications that Davion Mitchell does in terms of the massive shooting bump, but they both had a pretty massive shooting bump. And granted, Trey's free throw percentage came with him, but I don't think Trey Mann's the shooter he showed this year. That's the point I'm trying to make. So even if he was, though, for the sake of argument, it's possible to be a pretty prolific off the dribble shooter and not shoot as well off the catch, because those are two very different processes, especially for someone like Trey Mann, whose kind of entire diet this year was shooting off pick and rolls and very, very much less so off the catch. And so then we end up in this situation where like, it feels like the last 10 minutes of our conversation is null and void and that we're contradicting ourselves, but realistically we're not. It's just, that's how complex scouting is it requires the oscillation between macro and micro and everything in between. And there's a million different kind of, you know, data points across both. And it's up to us to do the impossible science of like perfectly weighting all of them correctly. And that is impossible. It's impossible science. It's why no one ever, you know, nails the draft every year. And guys get close because they, you know, do a very good job kind of filtering through the information in a better way than others do. But ultimately, it is really hard to do. So it's funny you said, like, I'm overcomplicating evaluating 19-year-olds playing basketball. I think it's just an insanely complicated practice, which is honestly why it's so fun, right? Like, we're solving these massively complex puzzles. That's like a blast, in my opinion. So yeah, I don't think you're being too hard. I think you are being too hard on yourself by saying that you're overcomplicating things. I think that's just the nature of the beast.
And like, I think, you know, we haven't even started to talk about how much fit plays in. And interestingly enough, I think what makes the draft so fun is that, like Henry said, it is an impossible science and you're evaluating all these things in a vacuum. And I think you can become cyclical in how you think about these and try to solve these problems in your head, because at the end of the day, like, the draft is both, it's like an economic experiment, it's a developmental experiment, and you're like weighting these things in concert, but without an ideal fit, you're missing information no matter how much information you have. But I think fit almost kind of helps or team, like once the actual draft happens. This is why I advocate doing both a pre and a post draft big board, is because like, if you talk about Trey Mann and you talk about his catch and shoot, like I buy it to a degree that Henry doesn't. And I think something that would really help crystallize whether or not I actually buy it is seeing where he lands on draft day. Because if he lands with like a Fred Vincent or something like that, like I buy that to a higher degree than I would now. Whereas if he lands with a team who either isn't committed to deploying him off ball, or he isn't going to be working with a guy who with a coaching staff who has the reputation for developing shooters, then I am less likely to buy that. And that's just one like micro skill in the whole assessment of one prospect in this like 60 player draft plus undrafted free agents plus exhibit 10 guys. So like, it just shows the scale of like what the questions we're trying to answer are and how much information you have missing, and how difficult that ends up being.
I'm going to push back a little bit there, Ev, because I do think this is a something I believe very strongly in my sort of big board creation. It's not right. Like, I'm not saying that this is the way to do it, but just an opinion I feel very strongly about. I don't, in my big board, have any intention of predicting outcomes. Like, I have no, I mean, obviously, okay, that was something to say. Obviously, I have some intention of predicting outcomes. But I don't, I mean that in the sense that I don't have, I'm not in the business of like guessing who's going to be good and who's going to be bad. I think that's an impossible practice. And like you said, it's easier to do after the draft. But like when I say certain things like Trey Mann 22, it's not like assuming he goes to a certain situation or assuming he doesn't, or like, I think that the, maybe this is unfair to say, I think we've kind of, as draft Twitter as a collective, has like given ourselves a giant out by being able to say like context. Like, yeah, context matters for sure. There's certain situations where context matters more than others, but like if context mattered as much as we make it out to be sometimes, there'd be no point in scouting these guys, right? Like if we could just draft guys and it wouldn't really matter how good they were, and just like if they went to the right context, it'd work out, and if they didn't, it wouldn't, then like we have no agency. Like, what are we spending our time doing? I know that's not what you're saying, I'm being dramatic, but like my point is, I think it's pretty important for myself to like say that any ordering of players I do, or saying I like a player or dislike a player, or think this player can be this or can be that, is never under the assumption that like he goes to a certain situation or he doesn't. And this is a problem I run into a lot with like people talking to me about Scotty, is I don't think, like, I get having Scotty lower on like this board where you're trying to guess outcomes, because if Scotty's put in a situation, which is very possible and honestly likely, because there's very few situations that work out well for him, where he's like, you know, A, expected to be like a full-time small ball five without much like insulation, or B, like be some sort of creator that's running pick and rolls, he's not going to look as good. But the reason I have Scotty five and why I'm super high on Scotty and will sing his praises about what he can become is because I know what I would do if I drafted Scotty. And I'm a firm believer that what I did with Scotty would work out really well. So I think that differs, and it's just a point worth making, because there is like a, you know, like I think the shooting coach thing is honestly a great example of, because like it's easy to say, you know, let me look at my board. Like, I don't know, let's just use a Scotty example. Scotty goes to the Pelicans and he's like becoming a knockdown shooter because he worked with Fred Vincent for 4 years. Yeah, I'd put Scotty a little bit higher. But it's just a, it's not a crutch, but it's just like a little bit of a sort of removal of agency that doesn't really make sense to me, in the sense that you, when you're a team, it's different, obviously, but we're no one works for teams. So I don't see the purpose in like guessing outcomes. I guess I do if you're like for fun doing like a post-draft board, like you mentioned, but like a pre-draft board or like ranking players, depending on your evaluations, I don't know how you could mix in the value of like them going to New Orleans versus Boston versus Sacramento versus Atlanta. Like, you have no idea where they're going on draft night. So how could you bake that in? It just seems like a fruitless practice to me. That's my rant for the episode.
No, and I 100% agree. So I appreciate that feedback, because I want to make sure to clarify my pre-draft big board is 100% my assessments, and it has nothing to do with where I think someone would land versus like the range that they're projected and what I would like to see from that range. So like a good example, I'm not fading James Bouknight because I think that he's going to be drafted top 10 and asked to become a primary, which I think is bad for his overall outcome. I'm ranking him in the 20s because I don't think I would take him earlier than that if I were drafting for, you know, X team that I'm building or whatever, based off what I value. And what I do with the post-draft big board, and this is actually the first year I'm doing it, so like it remains to be seen how valuable it is or whatever. But kind of what I'm doing with the post-draft big board is I do the pre-draft. I have full agency for that. And then once draft night happens, what I'm doing with the post-draft is kind of like, you know, I'm more looking at how far did James Bouknight drop because of where he was drafted versus where I had him. And it's more like a, it's more micro than it should be, but basically at a macro scale, I want to see like, okay, who was helped or hurt by the situation that they got drafted in? And that's more what I do the post-draft big board. It's like, okay, if you could tell me this guy was going to get picked by this team, I would drop him X number of slots, or rather it's like a power ranking almost. Like, so I do start kind of guessing outcomes when I get to that post-draft big board, because I'm like making bets on whether or not I think a team is going to develop a player in the way they need to be developed. But yeah, definitely my pre-draft big board is what I would compare like to other teams, or for example, or to outcomes, to get a good feel for like how I did and how my assessments worked, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think I can get a perfect example of this was Hallie last year. Like everyone, I think took it too far when everyone like was putting up big boards and was saying that Hallie was like not a top 10 pick, because if he was a top 10 pick, he would be, of course, because if he's a top 10 pick, it means he has to be thrust into this on ball role and he won't be that good at it because he can't create advantages and he can't generate any rim pressure. And even those people that said that also simultaneously correctly acknowledged that he had these like amazing connector skills. And then he gets drafted by the Kings and they've have the vision of like what makes Tyrese Haliburton good. And he looks really good. And like, I think no one got the evaluation wrong. Like it is a funny thing where everybody that was saying that they were low on Hallie in terms of like ordering all saw the same things that like are true today about what makes Hallie good. It's just that they, for whatever reason, were dubious that he would be allowed to show those things. And therefore they thought he wasn't going to be good because he'd be thrust in the wrong situation. And like in that scenario, you've made yourself wrong for no reason. Like you made yourself wrong for without even being wrong. You nailed the evaluation. You just overthought what teams were going to do with him. And there's no reason to really even do that, because of course we're not teams. So it doesn't matter what we think teams are going to do with them. It's just fascinating. Like I think there's hopefully a little bit, I think there's not as much an overcorrection this year as I thought there would be. But hopefully I think as things like that happen and teams get smarter, there's always going to be teams that misuse players, but as teams get generally smarter, there will be some correction there in terms of like trying to guess role and if player can succeed in the role that you think they might be given and all of that jazz.
And I was one of these people, which is why I've now decided to make a clear cut where I have stopped basically my own assessments. And now I am starting to factor in team fit. Whereas last year I tried to, I think it was a symptom of having too much time. I started to kind of galaxy brain it and do exactly like that with Hallie, where I was like, okay, well, if he's going to be taken in the top 10, they're going to force him to be a primary. And he was smart and he kind of decided his own destiny and got to a situation where he felt he would be developed correctly and that he would fit in well. And it worked out well for him. But yeah, I wanted to make a clear cut this year because trying to factor all that in tandem with your own assessments, it's impossible to weight them differently. They end up just being weighted in a way that you can't even look back on and measure. So yeah, it's an interesting thing to consider, but it's not something that I'd kind of consider in the metagame of making my own assessments.
And I think a lot of that gets caught by, you know, just baking in the possibility that a guy can play in a bunch of different roles into your big board and just elevating those guys, like we were talking about with someone like Scotty Barnes. This is why I have Jalen Johnson a little bit lower than him. In my opinion, Jalen Johnson is going to be someone who everybody wants him to do a certain thing, right? They want to see JJ play small ball five. They want to see him lead transition opportunities. And most likely he's not going to get the opportunities to do that. Like, it's not like this new team is like draft Twitter where they're like, oh, we need to go optimize Jalen Johnson now that we picked him. And so yes, there might be a situation in which he's allowed to do all those things that a lot of people are clamoring to see, but what will most likely happen is he won't. And then a lot of people will be like, oh, but he's not being used right. Yada, yada, yada. Having to be used a certain way is a drawback. Being able to fit in a bunch of different schemes is a skill. And I think Hallie, while he was kind of seen as a guy who needs to be used a certain way, he did kind of improve as a shooter, did run like some pick and rolls at like a rudimentary level, not to the point where you're running much through him. But I think that was kind of a key of his adaptation that we might be missing, is like, he also got better at like the things that allow you to play multiple roles. And he wasn't this specialized player that he kind of had the reputation for being pre-draft. So that kind of just traces back to like, yeah, the way you can kind of not worry about where a guy goes is just like players who can fit in a multitude of ways. It doesn't have to be a hard and fast rule, but it can be something that gives some guys an advantage over others when ranking them team agnostic. All right. So with that diatribe, I think that's the last one from me tonight. Stay tuned at Henry W. Ward on Twitter. You're going to want to follow this guy leading up to Thursday night. And I'll put everyone else's Twitter handles in the description. We are so close to 48 reviews. Cody, how you doing? I'm going to check in on you. How you doing?
There were a couple times I thought that I might have a question that was pertinent, but you all were so on fire that I'm like, you know what? I'm going to keep locking up Chris Paul instead.
I just completely realized Cody didn't say anything.
Cody's just vacationing in Draftland. How's the weather? Are you enjoying the weather here in Draftland?
Oh, it's the real weather is terrible, but I feel like I learned a lot. I feel like this was a lot higher level discussion than I needed to understand the draft, but that was a fun discussion.
Well, we appreciate you being along for the ride. It almost felt like you were the producer, you know, just hanging out and letting us do our things. But anyway, you'll hear more of Cody when we get to 48 ratings. He owes us 3 bad takes when that does happen. I believe we're only a handful of way. Mark put out some Premium Hoops podcast propaganda saying he wanted to catch us because they're at 39, and we can't let that happen because that would make Mark the villain Schindler a little bit too satisfied. He can never have that. So with all that being said, looking forward to the draft. I hope you are too. It's kind of the best night of the year, not even an exaggeration, and enjoy the rest of your day.